As a poet, translator, and teacher, Jonathan Stalling is intrigued with imaginaries, that collective imagination often found within cultures and communities. So it's no wonder that his first book of poetry, Grotto Heaven, would blossom out of a language textbook called The Practical Chinese Reader.
As you open this, the first thing you find are these diagrams. And so these are not real. They're not inner alchemy diagrams, but they are what I found sublime growing up and seeing these Bagua, Trigram, I Ching diagrams. It is a language of the void. It is an impossible language. They are visual representations. They're maps. They are beautiful.
Discover how the Chinese language intertwines with the poetry of Jonathan Stalling, who's also written the book Englische, now the first simultaneous Chinese and English opera, which we're hearing a bit of today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. We'll hear more of English later. Jonathan Stalling was born in Missouri and grew up in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, not exactly where you'd think a kid in the 1980s would learn Chinese. His fascination with the language led him to Chinese studies at Berkeley, then English literature and cultural theory at the University of Edinburgh, Scotland, and finally poetics at State University of New York, Buffalo. Now he's the editor of Chinese Literature Today at the University of Oklahoma, a translator of the Chinese poet Shi Zhi and the acclaimed book Winter Sun. Stalling also blends Chinese and English in his own work. He served as Beijing University's first Western poet in residence in 2015, the year his third book, Lost Wax, was published. We talked in 2013 about his first two, Grotto Heaven and Englische, Sinophonic English Poetry and Poetics. I asked Jonathan Stalling which intrigued him first, poetry or Chinese.
I wrote my first poem at 12. I didn't seriously start composing until later in high school. But Chinese definitely comes first. It was, from the beginning, more than an acquisition of a language. My first Chinese teacher emphasized the memorization of classical Chinese poetry, even from the first year that I was studying it. And so my exercise would be to go back and to memorize those prosodies to learn Chinese tones, pacing. What I didn't know at the time was that this pedagogy is traditional in China as well, not to learn how to speak a language, but to learn, in a sense, deep knowledge of what it means to participate in the Chinese literary tradition or even kind of cultural habitat in the most deep and long sense. And so Chinese students will usually have at least 10 to hundreds of poems memorized, even today, but before, those who had the recourse to education would be able to index poems per occasion and recite them in very specific ways. But it's also a tradition that offers people a still point. You know, these memorized poems stay forever. And while we change each time we reference them, each time we pull them up, you know, the contingencies alter the meaning of the poem, but the poems stay there. So I've been reciting these poems since I was an early adolescent.
How did you fall into studying Chinese at such a young age?
I can give you what I think are important influences. I grew up in a pocket culture, produced in counterculture. Both of my parents graduated with art degrees in Maryville, Missouri, but then moved and become part of this back-to-land movement, kind of neo-transcendentalism. And so we lived 15 miles away from Eureka Springs, Arkansas, a town of less than 2,000. Not a commune, it really is isolated, but incredibly, again, populated by these cultural formations. And so I grew up within multiple imaginaries over two marriages. The first with my mother and biological father. His influences were abstract expressionism and Zenism, sitting, meditation, and so on. So that's a Buddhist imaginary, important principally in the visual arts, but also in poetry, although he wasn't a poet, but a visual artist. So that's, you know, the first engagement. In the second marriage, my stepfather was a Chinese martial artist who taught Tai Chi Chuan and Xing Yi Chuan and Ba Gua Zhang, which are inner styles. And so that's a Taoist imaginary.
It fascinates me that you know, early on you realized that there were these parts to it, the mind and the body.
As a young person, it's not volitional. You're not seeking. You're not trying to find these things. This is just natural habitat. And so you're given a decision. Do you pursue the countercultural vector or direction? Do you run against it and run back to tradition so that you find roots? Or, in my case, do you become involved in a kind of meta-study of this culture that I am in? And that's what I do. As a scholar, I study Trans-Pacific poetics, and people like Ezra Pound or Ernest Fenollosa or Gary Snyder. Mm-hmm. You know, so my book, Poetics of Emptiness, is exploring cultural estuary spaces where the water is muddy and messy. New historicism gives me tools to understand how things have come about. What I'd like to do is to recite a poem and do it in a way that's called, it's called insong. It's a kind of sung version, but the prosody of the tones inside the poem create the harmony that you hear. So it's not an overlay of music onto the poem, although there's an aspect of exaggeration involved and creation for whoever it is who's chanting it. So they're idiosyncratic and they're personal. It's not a tradition that's passed down in any rigorous way, but it's unlike anything that I'm aware of in English. So this poem is by the poet Li Bai, so I'll just chant it now.
And I have to say, for our radio audience, you're not looking at a text. This is coming solely from memory.
Yeah. 朝辞白帝彩云间千里将临日还两岸猿声啼不住 We leave the city of Baidi at dawn under multicolored clouds. The town of Jiangling is 1,000 miles away and will make it in a single day. From both sides of the river, the monkeys cry without ending. And from our small boat, we've already passed 10,000 miles and 10,000 mountains. So the evocation of the emotion of the poem, which is, you know, a kind of buoyant but at the same time melancholy, the crying of the monkeys, the existential smallness of the boat against the landscape, is one that, you know, has, I think, a deep ambivalence in it. And that is completed in the sound. The practice of chanting it is, it's my way of experiencing the poem. As we enter my own work, there's an overwhelming interest in the sonority, not only of Chinese, but of my Chinese, that is of interlanguage, that is of the second language learner. And I continue to be fascinated by the accent as prosody. My accent, as well as accented English and from Chinese or other languages.
I'm Angela Elam, and I'm with Jonathan Stalling. And this is New Letters on the Air, as we talk about his relationship to poetry and also to Chinese language. I wasn't quite sure how to approach Grotto Heaven because it's divided up in parts. Maybe I should get you to talk about how you've structured the book.
The book is autobiographical in a way, in its structure, not necessarily linear. The first of the three parts is called Practical Chinese Reader. And as you've seen, it's an exact replica of my middle school grammar book from my Chinese class.
And actually, we get a sense of that again with...
Well, English is an English phrase book, so it's reverse
right.
Order. but clearly, language acquisition is no small thing. It is not to be relegated to some kind of acquisition for use, which I think often it is. And if you look at the way textbooks are put together, they have the artifice of use. Everything is about utility. When in fact, the apertures that are opened up in even a new vocabulary list, the histories and the words, the shapes of the sound, it is radical and dangerous. And to know the word not as a replacement or as the same as an English word, but to follow it out is to follow it past a return. And so there was something incredibly existentially exciting about learning Chinese as an adolescent. I mean, I didn't really seriously start learning Chinese until I was 13, even though I had been in this estuary for my whole life. But when it started in full, you know, going to my room and writing over and over again the characters. It was like punk rock, right? I mean, it was edgy and it was dangerous. And I had a sense of the palpable escape that was taking place every night. You know, for Arkansas, it was immersion. I had to travel 50 miles to my teacher's home in Fayetteville.
And was your teacher native, Jenny?
Yeah, she was from Sichuan and, you know, remains an important person. The book has some dedication to her and the acknowledgments, as does Inge Li Shi, in part because of her emphasis on poetry and sound, but because she welcomed me into her home. I would actually stay the night with them. I would go there on Friday and come back on Sunday sometimes. And, you know,
wow.
and they were really generous, opening their home up to me. And her husband was my calligraphy teacher. And I actually built up my entire high school curriculum out of independent studies through their networks at the university. And it allowed me to transform my public high school education into classes like three-dimensional shan shui painting, where I would, you know, do mountain painting and then create sculptures of these and talk about the Taoist miniaturization metaphysics and things, or Chinese tea, you know, and calligraphy, you know, and then language and so on. So they were very important and remain important to me.
Well, let's have you read a couple of these. And the nice part about it is that we get to see the Chinese in here. And then what you've written, I'm assuming that the Chinese characters, there's no way to translate verbatim because they don't have an alphabet like we do. Can you talk a little bit about the difference
sure.
in the
well,
languages?
You know, let's look at this section of the book opens up with a table of contents, right? And then it moves
which
to
comes from the book
from
that
the
you
form.
Were
mm-hmm.
in a way this is what I would refer to as a found poem, a series of found poems.
Yeah. And really, I mean, poetry is seems like it's always found. Let's say you have that sublime moment.
Good point.
As I did driving up last night where the sun set over the sunflowers in Kansas plains, and I was making a poem about the bug splots on my windshield, which were like stars, and, you know, it wasn't communicable, but it was found there, you know, and the form of it seems sublime. It's the transfer of the form that takes some kind of artful attention.
Right.
And so this book could look like a grammar book, or as I saw it, it is already and always was a poetry book. It's an angle at which I'm looking at this material that I'm hoping is transferred from my consciousness to the reader by way of the explicit framing of this as a poem. So this is from the expand through substitution drills. There are boxes of words you get to choose and put into the blanks. And so you would find this in every chapter. So the blanks go like, what appears as blank from blank slips away. What appears as a star from afar slips away. What appears as a distance from a mesa slips away. What appears as an opening from thought slips away. What appears as an escape from language slips away. What appears as an entrance from below slips away. And then the next one, blank pushes harder than blank pulls. Anything pushes harder than nothing pulls. Nothing pushes harder than anything pulls. That form, when I first did it, you know, first experimented, it felt like an epiphany. Like, wow, of course. That just happened every time. So in the next section on just grammar, which is translated as language law, is what I think ought to be grammar of language acquisition, which is anti-imperial, not about mastery, actually, but about quite the reverse, moving out into the unknown and disappearing there. And there isn't a return. Not to the same place. That's the goal, if there's a goal. It's to attend darkness without an allergic reaction to not knowing where you are at that point, to be at one with the experience of the unknown, to attend to it in its particularity without having to master it. And that's language acquisition, because once you have it, you're already different than what you were. And so just one from those, you know, 外国语是什么? What is foreign language? The category of foreignness does not here refer to language, but a relation to their power to mean without yielding to the subject's mind. Mastery forgets the weight of the foreign, that its obscure mass and energy will always dictate the outrushing of the universe.
Mm.
The three pieces go together, especially the first two on the theme of darkness, equating foreignness with linguistic obscurity. I will never know Chinese. I can't. I write in it, you know, I'm immediately unable to feel deeply. I have to go slow and unearth slowly a kind of archaeology. It is translation, which is a method, a practice. It isn't spontaneous. It unfolds very slowly. So I can be in Chinese and operate there, and I do professionally, but I can't live in this space and ever feel like I'm, you know, native to it. So it's always uncomfortable in a way. But I'm quite comfortable with that discomfort. Interlanguage is my home. I don't want to be native. And that desire for mastery faded decades ago. So Grotto Heaven is the extension of this into the darkness. And that actually returns us to Arkansas because it's about caves in, you know, in the land that I grew up in.
Right. Grotto Heaven is the name of the collection by Jonathan Stalling. And you're listening right now to New Letters on the Air.
From then on, we move into a series of the cave poems, which are quite literal movement of a particular cave in the Ozarks.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. So maybe one of these?
She has.
Yeah, okay. The first and most legible one is the first one called Arriving Lai Dao. It's also a visual poem. They're couplets. The first line is above the earth, and the second line is below the earth in each one. So above the earth. Rust, riverbed roads, line with trees of dried sunfish. Eyeless fish swim down darkless tunnels. A truck kicks red dust up against the banks. Flowstone smooths down to vein's origin. A farmhouse is a man who bends space around his children's eyes. Seeds drip from stone straws and grow in, if not a rhythm, imagination. The spring pools outside perfectly clear and cold. Speleothem albras spill from flowstone. Eyes claim space as if from origin. Pupils bloom nocturnal to swallow your eyes whole. And then we go down into the thing. So the Ozarks are karst mountains right there, limestone soluble. And so, you know, some of these sinkholes that we see increasingly disrupting human habitation, you know, come from this labyrinthine underworld. And the Ozarks is, you know, completely riddled with subterranean complexity.
Right.
And,
exactly.
And so this is, you know, one of these spaces. So last one, short, fourth one called Dark. Turn off the lamps. Even hands are on the other side. Close your eyes. Behind the retina. Now open and open again. Darkness is not a phenomena or a place, not what, but how we see.
That's a little bit from the book Grotto Heaven. You're listening to Jonathan Stalling, and this is New Letters on the Air. I love the fact that you talk about the darkness because we end up looking at constellations at the end of this book and seeing light. Well, now you're the editor of Chinese Literature Today, the magazine. It seems to me this is your life work. Is that correct?
Well, I guess it's so far, right?
That and raising your children. You have three children.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, the third part of Grotto Heaven connects to that, right? Which is the first parts are all about how do you attend to otherness. But it doesn't really acknowledge that my being is already plural, that being a parent to love others is to, as I say, is to become a lodge. And so that section is called Lodged, and it means that we lodge others. We are lodged by them. But like a bullet, it's intractable.
Right.
You know, it's lodged, and it's not coming out. There's no outside of the plurality. So, you know, being a parent is very important. And being a husband and son and brother and so on. You know, it's a big part of my poetics and life's work, like you said. It all rushes together.
I would love to hear you read the poem from that section called The Space.
Oh, sure. The Space for Amy. Opened by your voice. Cannot be reduced to body or language, yet the I that takes place here isn't one without it. The movement and event of the sounding itself is the lodge the taking place of us, appears here in the encounter which opens as our own. A self is a rupture in awareness, housing windows, bridging the echo's return, and forgetting the mirror's immensity, polishing cannot vanish the obscure approach. Becoming the chamber of a self isn't a place or a presence, just the name of returning to or from the sound of your voice. It might be important to read, you know, these are kind of connected, they're sort of arbitrarily titled. Love sounds like a kind of distance, is spelled like a kind of distance, means in most cases what distance means when flown into becoming the space of us. And, you know, the Lodge poems come from being very unsatisfied with what we talk about as love or as marriage or, you know, like romantic love or parental love. It just seems really unthought through, the kind of cultural language we bring to subjects like this. And so the Lodge is trying to get at the same kinds of questions that Grotto Heaven and others do about otherness and our relation to it, but then what happens when you recognize at the base we are other. And so the book ends with this image from an alchemical text from at least 1,500 years ago, and it has a man with Chinese characters all over his body, and the characters are names of different constellations, which in Chinese xiu is the word for lodge. And so constellations become the kind of figure for the human being. And so it ends with a ridiculously lyrical line, "Friends, we are constellations for a night, then disappear in the light." And that, you know, ends the book and hopefully marries the three sections.
You're listening to Jonathan Stalling today talk about his work in his collection Grotto Heaven. I'm Angela Elam, and this is New Letters on the Air. So where do you want to go next?
You know, I would love to spend a moment with my next book, Englishi.
It's got a subtitle, too, Sinophonic English Poetry and Poetics.
Yeah.
And it's taking another step from Grotto Heaven and stretching what you were doing there in a little bit different direction.
They open with the same poem.
Right. I noticed that. Yeah.
And so it is an extension of Practical Chinese Reader. Now, a lot can be said about the book by its title, and it actually explains itself. It is, in fact, probably the shortest poetics manifesto. It is self-contained. Englishi is what I call sinophonic English, which means it's English that is produced by a recombination of Chinese character sounds. For those who have traveled to China or interact with second language learners from China, the first level of acquisition is a heavy saturation of Chinese recombined in this way. And so someone might ask you if you speak English so that they can practice it. It might, "Can you speak Englishi?" You know, this would be, you know, maybe first-year learner or an older generation who still has a lot of linguistic transference. And so this is actually spoken by more human beings than are Americans alive. You know, 350 million second language learners of English in China, the majority of whom haven't studied abroad, haven't had access to native instruction, and thus have high sinophonic saturation. And so this is a world language, and it's a real one, and I wanted to spend time, like myself, you know, with my imperfect Chinese, and I see this aperture and the estuary as important to kind of find a space in. This English is really appealing to me because this is my two languages. And the imperfection of it feels like, you know, something I deeply can connect with my own imperfect tones and imperfect Chinese. So I rewrote this, an English phrase book that uses Chinese characters to teach English, and changed each character to create poetry in Chinese. So it is an opera. It's a libretto that was performed in China in 2010. And if you are a Chinese speaker, it's going to mean one set of things. And if you're an English speaker, it will mean another set of things. If you know both languages, it is a dizzying cohabitation of meaning. So, yin ge li shi yin, when I chanted the poem at the beginning, that was yin song. It means to chant. Ge, in ge, ge means song. Mei li de li is beauty, li. Shi is poetry. Chant, songs, beautiful poetry. These are the words that mean yin ge li shi. It is a reversal of the yellow-faced minstrel kind of sense of Chinglish as a derivative fallen language of ridicule, and it tries to open an aesthetic space where we can hear, find a new structure of feeling for interlanguage, not haunted by the tragic kind of overlying of the two languages in our popular imagination. And so what happened is when I wrote the book, as I already just mentioning the one phrase, it's an anxious place to speak this interlanguage as a non-Chinese person, as a white man, shall we say bluntly. To say this is a difficult thing to do. So it was important for me to go to China and to collaborate, to find the musical scale, which can open what my ears hear to the reader without there being this rejection or this humorous thing. So two parts. One is the poems are not funny. To the last one.
They're actually quite beautiful.
They have an aesthetic of melancholy beauty with sutra language, but it is melancholic. And let me, you know, there's no better way into this than just chanting a poem. So the songs, when sung, are sung to folk tunes, minority folk tunes, that then focus on the meaning of the Chinese characters. The byproduct of English is our reading into it. So let me do a really short one real quick called Apologies. And the meaning of the poem, a team of four bold and vigorous horses, snow-covered mountain peak overshadows, heightened solitary learning, vast private profits, Buddha offers impermanent mysteries. I have to tune the listener to hear it. So the English phrase is, please, I apologize. Please forgive me. Police, I apologize. Police, forgive me.
Jonathan Stalling chanting Apologies from his book Englische, Sinophonic English Poetry and Poetics. An opera of the English and Chinese poetry has been performed in China, and Stalling hopes to see it in the U.S. Here's part of a recording of that ongoing project from his website. 第一个特，第一个特。Links to Jonathan Stalling's books and his website where you can hear more of Englische, visit newletters.org and click On the Air. There's also a link to The Conversant with Stalling's 2014 TEDx talk. Or you can click on ways to listen to sign up for our free podcast. You can also follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with help from Jamie Walsh, Ross Steinmetz, and Stephanie Hughes. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.